From KCRW, this is Here Be Monsters. A quick content note, this episode includes talk of sex trafficking and sexual abuse.
I gave my testimony on Friday during the fellowship because the subject of the fellowship was on pagpapasakop sa Panginoon, surrendering your life to God. I told them that I used to work at a residential treatment facility for abused and neglected children. That I thought that because I was raised in such a good home with such loving parents, that I could pass that on to these children in need. I've seen every way, just about every way. I've seen countless ways in which a human being can hurt a child. The children would often be violent. Most often they would have been victims of rape. And in some cases, perpetrators of rape themselves. I told them that because the children were so violent that we would often have to put them in physical restraints, hold them with our own bodies to keep them safe. They were a cause, they weren't real people. They were stories to be saved, objects to be saved. I told them that I did it for 5 years. I told them that the average career at the center was a year, because after a year, you'd have enough secondary trauma and you'd move on, do something safer, less traumatic. But I did that for 5 years. And that I did that for a year and a half too long, because after 3.5 years, I had burned out. Baliw is the word that I used. Baliw means crazy. I told them that I was broken. That I didn't think that I could work with children again. That I didn't think I could be a therapist because I was too broken. I told them I went to grad school, to the Seattle School of Theology and Psychology, not for a counseling psychology degree, to become a therapist, but for a theology and culture degree, to find myself. One of my first classes, I heard the professor talking about hope and how hope will invite us into more pain. How hope will kill us in the end. Not the most cheerful thing to say, but something very important for somebody who wants to be a therapist to hear. And this prompted me to look up into the rafters and ask, Lord, what would be the hardest thing you could ever possibly ask me to do? And I got a verbal answer. In my head, I heard someone say, maybe you should work with sexually trafficked girls in the Philippines. My first reaction, honest to God, was, fuck you. Why would you say such a thing? How could you ask me to do such a hard thing? Me? I'm broken. I'm done. I had not gone back to the Philippines in over 15 years. I had no plans to go back to the Philippines. I had no knowledge about sexual trafficking or human trafficking. At that time, I didn't even know that I was a child of sexual abuse myself. How could I go back to the Philippines, being so broken, not having made anything of myself? What did I have to show for leaving home?
Here Be Monsters, the podcast about
what I imagined they would be.
The podcast about
the unknown.
Was told that I was special, that I have a responsibility to use that specialness for the country. And then I left the country. Filipinos have been going to different nations and different lands to make fortunes for themselves, to find opportunities that they couldn't find here for centuries now. And you basically don't come home until you've made your fortune. And I felt like I gave up on being a part of the future of the country. And then at that time, I thought my job was to glorify God through my art, and became an actor. And because theater was so lucrative, I had to get a day job. And my day jobs were all in the care industry. Taking care of the elderly, the developmentally disabled, and started working with kids. Had to give up all notions of becoming a professional artist, though I found that working with kids, you get to be an artist all the time. You get to tell stories all the time. I found a purpose in working with abused and neglected kids. But I also burnt out really hard. And then I went into grad school. I wanted to be a therapist, but at the start, I didn't think I could be because I was so burnt. What I actually did find was permission to become a therapist, because I found that being broken actually helps if you're a therapist. So now I'm here in the Philippines working with an organization that helps women who are both vulnerable and have been prostituted.
Ate Minda is the social worker in charge of outreach. She showed up and was asking about who would join her. So I joined the outreach. And me and Ate Minda would go to Cubao and Quezon Avenue. I was so nervous, waiting to go. I brought my ball. I nervously just flipped it around in my hands, on my arms.
Hi, Carlo.
I am just needing to replace these batteries.
Why were you afraid to do outreach? What frightened you?
Sure.
I was afraid to do outreach because when I was first thinking about coming here, I would periodically cry. I would find myself weeping because I would be imagining the lives of the women here, and I would cry at how tragic their lives were, how hungry they were, how hurt they were by the world. And then I realized that I was crying about their lives even if I had never met them, even if I hadn't actually experienced their humanity. And maybe they're not as sad, or maybe their lives aren't exactly the way I imagined them, me, who hadn't been in the Philippines for a long time. And I realized that I might have not been crying for them, but for what I imagined they would be. And how arrogant that is, to be like, I know what your life is going to be, and I think your life is really sad, so you must be tragic. It's not my place to say who they are. I didn't want to objectify them. I didn't want the chance to objectify them. But, you know, I was called to do this, you know? I have to show up.
What do you think would have happened if you had received that call from God and understood it in that way and said, I'm not doing that?
My calling from God to do this work is not a deal. It is more of like a revelation of what I was supposed to do, what I was intended to do before time, before I was even created, before the world was ever created, before prostitution was ever created, before abuse, before hunger, before poverty. I was intended by God to fight it, fight back the darkness, however I could. When we got to Cubao, we got off the bus. The streets were damp because it had rained that day, as it rains most days. Puddles everywhere of black, dark, gross water. The filth of one of the most polluted cities in the world. and amidst the shops and the hustle and bustle of one of the busiest intersections in the city, came upon two women, one who was selling candy and cigarettes one at a time. The other woman was sitting, holding a bag in front of her belly, because I found out later that she was pregnant. Ate Minta introduced me as somebody with her, and I shook the hand of the first one, and I offered my hand to the second one, and when the second one didn't reach for my hand, I pulled it back, awkwardly. They gave us chairs to sit on, plastic chairs. Then I sat behind Ate Minta and just sat there awkwardly, looking around, not knowing whether to look them in the face or the eyes, whether it be rude. I put on a plastic smile that I thought was non-threatening. We sat there for a while, Ate Minta making some idle chit-chat, me just sitting there awkwardly, until Ate Minta found some kids. One was the daughter of the first woman we met. The other two were daughters of prostitutes as well. At one point, a skinny kid just ran away into the crowd. And nobody noticed because his mom was lying on cardboard on the sidewalk trying to get some sleep. They had been there for 3 straight days. And they couldn't go home until they made some money. I was worried about the skinny kid. After about 10 minutes of wondering, he came running back holding a juice pouch. The kind you put a straw in. They said that he had begged it off of somebody. There was a big roly-poly kid that looked like me. They said that we looked like father and son. There was this scrawny, tiny boy with a raspy voice. His hair tied in a tuft on top of his head. His limbs were just about as skinny as 2 of my fingers put together. And they gravitated towards me and grabbed R2-D2 hanging from my bag. This droid and I have been through a lot together. I asked Ate Minta if it would be alright for me to bring out my ball. I have a contact juggling ball that lights up. I can flip the ball around on my arms and roll them on my chest, and the children gleefully were saying, "He can do magic." We found an open space in front of a department store, and I proceeded to do tricks with my ball. While Ate Minta was talking to their parents, I played with the children. As usual, it was easy for me to play with the children because all I needed to do was be a child myself, yeah? The children were fascinated with how the light changed on the ball, pass it to them and have them throw it to me, and I would catch it with the back of my hand. And they all wanted a turn. At first I tried to balance the ball on the back of their hand, and their hands were too small, and the ball was too heavy. The scrawny kid could barely hold the ball with two hands. Passing the ball back and forth was the best. The children asked their parents if they could go with me. And the children said that the parents said yes. I told them no, they couldn't. I should have asked their names. That's how you make friends, you ask their names. I was too nervous.
I think we all define God out of our own experience. Not that we are all our own God. That I don't think that's true. It is the part of God inside us that makes us the most happy, makes us the most creative, makes us the most loving. And that's the part of us that will last forever. And won't fade away, won't die, won't, ultimately won't fail.
We took a taxi home. In the cab, I started worrying at a piece of meat that was stuck in my teeth. And I had jabbed it in deeper, and my tooth started hurting. And when I got home, it was the most painful thing in the world. And I had yelled at God, "Why me? Why now? Didn't I do enough? Why do I have to go through so much pain?" I pounded the walls here at Samaritana. I stomped my feet and yelled at God to take the pain away. And I prayed myself to sleep.
Amen.
Carlo Nacar works in Quezon City, Philippines. He'll soon return to Seattle to finish his counseling degree at the Seattle School of Theology and Psychology. While working with me on this story, Carlo traveled to India to attend a conference hosted by the International Christian Alliance on Prostitution. He attended a presentation on OSEC, online sexual exploitation of children, and for a second time, he felt called by God. He's not sure how or where, but after graduation, he intends to find work as a therapist for children who have been sexually exploited online. On our website, we have photos that Carlo shared of Samaritana, the organization where he's been working. Find it at hbmpodcast.com. While you're there, check out our store, where we'll be selling a book version of our recent two-part series, Beautiful Stories About Animal Death. We're really proud of this little book. It's filled with gorgeous photos and has an amazing orange and pink cover that looks like some kind of intergalactic soup. Find it at our store, hbmpodcast.com/store. I'm Bethany Denton, and I produced this episode. I had lots of editing help from Jeff Emdman. Music on this episode came from The Black Spot and Circling Lights. Here Be Monsters is distributed by KCRW. Our senior editor there is Nick White. We get additional support for freelance contributions from KCRW's independent producer project. Thanks for listening. More episodes soon. How do we know each other, Carlo?
Yeah, we know each other from a friend group, from parties. I was a roommate of some of your college friends. But since then, we've become friends of our own accord. And we've even recorded a podcast together. Full disclosure, the podcast on my own circumcision. I certainly tell that story in a really different way these days. I certainly don't tell it for comedic effect.
Right. Well, so you know? just for context, the episode that you're referring to is...
Yeah, the episode I'm referring to is Chuck Gets Cut, I believe is what it's called.
Chuck Gets Circumcised, yeah.
Oh, Chuck Gets Circumcised. Episode 8.
Yeah, the very first episode of Here Be Monsters that I ever produced.
And so I'm in that waiting room, and I don't know. I feel a tingle, not on my penis, but just it's like I'm gonna change today. I'm gonna grow up today. Today is going to end with me different. And I don't know if I was afraid. I don't think I was afraid. I think I was expectant of something.
Actually, what's interesting, more likely than not, everything we're working on right now will be episode 107. So this will be 99 episodes later.
Significant.
But anyway, you and I have talked about this. I think you said something along the lines of like, I sort of cringe at the glee with which I...
I do cringe at the glee that I used to tell that story. And the uncomfortable reactions of the people who heard it feels really irresponsible and kind of a betrayal of a very confused and scared little boy, you know? I've been a lot nicer to 12-year-old me since then, and... did you know that the notion... Okay, I did some study. I've written about circumcision in the Philippines. And 75% of the people who get circumcised in the Philippines say that the reason they get circumcised is to not be teased about not being circumcised. So it's basically toxic masculinity that makes people... cut their foreskin off at the age of 12. So there's shitty things about that.
For what it's worth, and granted, I'm partial because I had a hand in making that. And I totally, you know, while also completely hearing and, you know, agreeing with your assessment of, like, the sort of the problematic ways in which you used to tell that story and sort of the beats you used to hit for comedic effect or whatever. When I think about that episode and I think about that story, more what comes to mind for me than the body horror of it is the fact that it's like one of relatively few occasions that I can think of that people have to make the decision to grow up, to say, I am growing up now in this way. Because, you know, that happens constantly, right? Like, or I should say, in particularly American society, in Western society, it happens constantly where there are little acts of agency that young people can exercise that in big ways and in small ways are ways of asserting adulthood. To me, when I think about that, it's like, that was a time where you asserted adulthood in a very tangible, irreversible...
Very tangible.
Very painful way, yeah.
You know, if you put it that way, I kind of think of it as like, maybe every time I told that story, I was asking myself to grow up. And when I finally stopped laughing at it, was when I actually did grow up.